very important in the non-supersymmetric theories, of course, to also investigate the cortex. We did that for all models which we've shown. Okay. We know, we are aware of models which do have fixed points in the KQ Kawa sector, but which fail to have stable vacua in the cortex sector. So it is a non-trivial test.
So can I follow up on the question of stable vacua? So you looked at that with the quartic couplings, or did you really did a global study of the potential? Because, I mean, the quartics just tell you whether it will be unstable around the origin, right? But you might still have a potential that is bounded from below.
Yes, we did that.
Okay, so it's a full potential, and you can really show instability in some of these cases.
What do you mean by instability?
So you just said you will have some cases where the potential isn't stable. So I was just wondering whether you looked at that in an expansion around the origin and field space, or whether you looked at that globally for the potential.
Yes. Now I understand the question. Okay, good. So what we did is we studied a large variety of KQ Kawa theories, and we found examples where quartics don't give a stable potential.
Okay. So there might still be global stability.
Oh, yes, of course.
Okay.
It might be that these guys develop, nevertheless, due to sexic higher order interactions, yes, which would be an interesting phenomenon, by the way,
of course.
Yes, this can very well happen. Okay? Yes. Leading order and perturbation theory, you would think, well, if that happens, then
yes,
it would be very interesting, but then something else probably has happened as well. So the opposite is also true in some of those models, say, for example, the model which we were putting up with Francesco, okay, we in fact investigated the potential. Okay, so those theories, these are theories which have, you know, we have some matrix, scalar field, Hij, and so we can write down to quartics, right? To quartic interactions, and we know the potential is stable there, but then you can think about higher order invariants and write down certain general potentials for these. So the neat thing in that is that if you have a perturbatively interacting fixed point, so a theory where the corresponding quartics in these couplings are small, some more epsilon, then you can make a very systematic expansion even for these higher order ones and find actually close expressions for the global potential which remains stable. So in the same spirit, say you could have asked, well, maybe some higher dimensional operators destabilize the vacuum at some point, okay, and so maybe it's worth having a look into that. And what came out of that investigation, which my student Kuba, for your business, presented at the latest conference a year ago, okay, is that in fact the theory remains stable, as one would probably have.
I think there were further questions for Daniel.
Mine was pretty much the same. So the table, at some point you gave a set of equations with fixed points for alpha G and alpha Y that was neglecting the quartic couplings, right?
The thing here is quartics have too many legs, as the name tells you. Mm-hmm. So they cannot make a show before two loop in the Kawa or three and four loop in the gauge. So they are simply not there. They are not there. They exist, couplings exist, but they do not couple back.
Okay.
So there is a disentangling of the system at that order in the loop expansion.
So you set it to zero and then you wait until it is generated by the gauge coupling? What is the...
No, it's non zero. It doesn't contribute that loop order. Okay? So it is following its own beta function, which I have neglected to discuss.
Because at one loop they don't appear.
In one loop, in their own beta function, they mix with the Kawas, which the scalars are.
You're just saying that the one loop equations for gauge and Yukawa are not affected by.
The one and two loop, exactly. So the one and two loop of the gauge, okay, and even the three loop if the scalars are not charged, don't see anything of this quartets, okay? And the first appearance they do make is at two loop level for the Yukawas. That's already a subleading correction, because the fixed point to leading order and perturbation theory is generated
from the two loop in the gauge and the one loop in the Yukawa.
So that those equations were at one loop in the Yukawa.
Yes. That's the leading order. So the equations, so the way you have to think about it is leading order. So the leading order, the leading non-trivial order in the gauge sector is two loop, and it so happens by the nature of what Yukawa interactions are, the leading order in the Yukawa sector is one loop. Because you have contributions from the Yukawas and from the gauge, and something can cancel and generate a zero. The gauge sector, at one loop, you only have gauge fields, so to speak, one term sitting there. It cannot cancel against anything else, which is why you must go to two loop to see any cancellations.
So this, you're sort of partly answering it, but I just want a clarification. If you said it, I'm sorry, I missed it. So everything you did is for weak coupling.
Absolutely.
Right, and your definition of weak coupling is perturbative only, no all orders, summation of anything, or can you clearly define?
Yes, it's very clearly defined. Perturbative fixed point means a fixed point which exists to each and every order of equation.
To all orders.
To each and every order.
Okay. So, but you haven't done an all orders summation of anything in your analysis.
No, I don't have to, but maybe somebody who's smarter than I am is able to do that. Okay, but yes. So, but the whole point here is that what you get for all your couplings, yes. Okay, for all your couplings, you get some numbers, let me call them number I, numbers of order unity. All couplings are power series in the small parameter, which is one loop gauge coefficient. Okay? And so this series can be computed in perturbation theory, okay? And each additional loop order will generate a higher power in B. So in that sense, we have an exact perturbation theory. That's how we define it.
And that's alpha star?
Yes, that's the fixed point when I'm okay. Now my point of this being a solution to each and every order in a perturbation theory. Why is there a point with that? As soon as you jump over an order in a perturbation theory, yes, it means that some higher order in perturbation theory is, so to speak, unnaturally cancelling a lower order, which is then implying that the coupling has become of, say, order unity or large in a perturbative way of looking at things. So for now, I want to take this perhaps conservative looking point of view, which states that I would want to find quantum field theories for now which have this feature. Okay, and I do know how I can find some of those. So these animal exists. Yes? But of course, what is also true is that you can now push the boundary and ask yourself, okay. Maybe, you know, things we don't have a large end limit, and so we have to explore these boundaries a little bit. Okay, so for example, since you mentioned resummations, okay, think of the Banks-Sachs fixture. That's a good example. Okay, I was saying that there is a Banks-Sachs fixed point, which in this terminology is B over C, to leading order in B being a small parameter. Now, what we could do is you could think of your beta function as being the following element. Let me write it like this. Okay? Without adding order alpha to the 4. Okay, so I'm imagining that I now have whatever. Maybe fermions in my theory, okay, only a gauge theory coupled to fermions. Okay, one gauge coupling. And maybe I'm smart and I'm able to resum that. In which case I can write the result as this. Okay, why not? Okay? So the expressions I wrote down are formally still correct. Okay? So then I would get an implicit equation which defines what the fixed point in fact is. It's just like simple algebra. Okay? Now, what's the difference now? So the whole point here is what I've been able to show in perturbation theory is that if B is negative, but say small, then necessarily C is positive. Okay? And of course, say if you believe the work by Pedro Pasquale and later on John Gracie, okay, which have computed large NF, QCD, yes, and made certain resummations of this type, they would say, okay, if we can trust these infinite NF resummations, then what's going to happen now non-perturbatively? So this means, remember, this means no UV makes sucks. Okay? Now we can believe those resummations, okay, let's imagine that for a split second, yes, then effectively it means that since these find the UV fixed point at B negative, so we know that C at some alpha band sucks actually has become negative. Okay? So here the sign change is a strong coupling effect, a large order effect, okay, an all-order resummation effect. Yes? So this here means simply, say if I is that coefficient at alpha equals zero, which is just the ordinary two-loop coefficient. Okay? So now I have totally resummed these expressions. Okay. It may very well, as being suggested by these large NF investigations, that now the sign might change. Okay? So this is like infinite and F both QED and QCD. Okay? So these things could in principle happen, but so for now we do not have, so to speak, very super hard results, okay, but we have, I think, fair indications that maybe something could be going on there. So what is normally the criticism, yes, so the criticism, so these results, remember, they are from QET, I think it was 83 or 84, and QCD, I think 96, okay, and so what still is not known is the complete 1 over NF correction to the infinite NF result. That would certainly be a highly valuable result to have in our hands, because the first sub-median correction will tell us whether there is some funny anomaly going on at exactly NF infinity, okay, or whether this NF equal infinity fixed point is something which persists down the finite. We do know in quantum field theory there are examples of things which only happen at n equal infinity and no vicinity of n equal infinity. Okay? But for example, for this phenomenon, we do not know. Okay? But it so turns out that that computation is a tiny bit tricky, so people have generated partial results, which is already very good. Okay, and maybe somebody can come up with a smart idea, you know, and maybe find some new tricks to do this investigation. So this is certainly something which would be very valuable for people to know. Because, you know, because this could pave the way to understanding a mechanism. Okay. So why is n equal infinity and f infinity so tricky? Okay. And f equal infinity is very strongly coupled. Okay. Alpha looks small, in another dimension of the fermions look small, okay? But now you compute the scaling exponent. Now the scaling exponents, if you compute them in these weakly coupled quantum field theories, okay? Yeah, so this, what are the scaling exponents? Remember, the phase diagrams we had, interacting fixed point, Gaussian fixed point, something is running out, okay? And so the velocity with which alpha gauge, alpha nu kappa, the velocity with which I'm running away from the fixed point is controlled by the scaling exponent. Okay? As we know, out of the Gaussian we normally run with logarithmic velocity, but out of an interacting fixed point we run with a power law. Okay? So power law is an RG scale over some reference RG scale to some eigenvalue. Universal number, let me call it theta. Okay? So in this quantum field theory, in the perturbative setting, we can compute these thetas. And these thetas are then ultimately functions of B, or small parameter, and they turn out to be power series in B. So in short, these are small numbers. Okay? We often have eigenvalues which are, so this eigenvalue is of order B, this eigenvalue here is even smaller, order B squared, that one. Okay, small thing. Now,
So, okay, so this gives you a feeling for how weakly coupled the theory is, okay? It's running is faster than logarithmic, yes, but it's a very mild power because the exponent is small. Now you go back to Pasquale and Grayson. And if you compute now the scaling exponent, okay, some of you might have done that, okay, it's a simple enough thing, yes, theta, yes, goes to, so to speak, infinity. Okay? So you, and that's the side effect of NF equal infinity. So it tells you that you would want to have the 1 over NF correction to it, to really see is this settling somewhere, okay, or is something else going on. We need to know those things. Say, this is a substantially different running from, okay, something which is has a perturbatively small exponent versus something which has an infinitely big exponent, okay? So the running, right, so in a way you can see, yes, you can also see it with, if you just put your beta function, yes, the beta function is asymptotically non-free, okay, but in the NF equal infinity limit, it goes down, yes, just emit whatever, okay, I mean it's like 2 kilometers, straight down, okay, yes, and the slope is your scaling exponent, okay? So, be it as it may, you know, this is how it is, yes, these are the theories, yes, the important thing is maybe, you know, people come forward and they are doing an important computation, maybe trying to figure out what is the next correction to this large NF result, which would be really a very useful type of result to have.
So that's probably the first thing on our roadmap for the end of the week.
Yes, no, I certainly think so because there are many people, many of you, started playing around with large NF ideas. Okay, and so say this is kind of the large NF. Somehow I don't know. Okay, so the way I try to operate, it doesn't work always. Yes, I try to have some corner where I feel safe at home. Okay, yes, and so I'm so happy that we found this corner. The gauge theory is where for now at least perturbation theory is valid, you know, it's like it feels like paradise. If we've been doing quantum gravity for 15 years, it's suddenly something totally new. Territory, yes, where you can, okay, where you totally know these results are exact. Okay? So I personally believe it's very important to find such anchors. Regions where we solidly can drop an anchor, where we have a hard, solid standing result of whatever. And certainly large NF type of ideas offer an important playground to generate such type of results. Okay? We might not like all aspects of these results, okay, but this is always how it is, okay? And it is important to generate, however, these milestones, because these serve, yes, so these will be very important to make future steps on. Okay.
I think there was a question.
Yeah. Now that you brought it up, this thing about the scaling exponent, right? I mean, this scaling exponent should go to minus infinity, right?
Yes, depending on how you define the sign, that's fine.
But the problem is that then is, at least to me, I had this doubt, how do you define the F square operator inside the UV CFT? Because that scaling dimension should break completely the unitarity bound. So in some way, the F square that should be the operator driving the flow should not be there. Or is the couple? So I have trouble like concealing this picture of this thing that you have a scaling dimension that goes to infinity. To what is in that CFT, in that UV CFT?
Yes.
So
fair enough. I'm not sure I have a very good answer. Okay. So you have to understand what type of computation it is. Okay. It's a perturbative computation taking a certain set of diagrams and then making an infinite approximation of these, okay? Out comes something which, in one way, looking at it, looks nice and possibly weakly coupled because the fermion number's dimension looks parametrically small, okay? So the gauge beta, the sum gauge beta function doesn't look like super crazy, but then it dips off strongly, okay? So but then the scaling exponent comes out so heavily. Okay, so there are a couple of questions which needs to be asked. Okay, yes. So my conjecture is that this theory, in fact, is in some sense wrong. Okay, and probably one has only addressed half or a fraction of the question, because you have to start somewhere. Maybe one would even have to think about higher order invariants, because if the theory is strongly coupled, then F-cubed interactions will be switched on. Maybe something is going to happen with the anomalous dimensions. We don't know that. We don't have the control parameter which tells us that this is not going to happen. Okay. In the perturbative setting, at least, yes, you can forget about that type of trouble, because since it's weakly enough coupled, yes, you can just focus on couplings which have vanishing canonical mass dimension. Those which have negative mass dimension will be relevant. Those that have positive mass dimension will be relevant no matter what you do, because it's weakly coupled. So you only have to figure out what happens with the marginal mass. They will tip into one or the other direction. That's it, okay? But not all problems are as simple as that one, regrettably, yes. And I don't know any better answer to your question, but I totally agree that there are a number of interesting questions which can be asked and maybe should be asked.
Okay, so I would propose that we now close the part of the discussion that's sort of related directly to Daniel's talk and go to a more general bit. So there was already a list of questions that was submitted, but maybe there is something else that somebody wants to urgently discuss now, maybe coming out of the first half of the day. Okay, then I think two possible topics relate either to what does all of this have to do with gravity, how does gravity come into the game, but maybe that's also a topic that we can come back to later in the week. Maybe following up on Daniel's results, that's the whole question of supersymmetry. So I think, Rob, you had a question.
Well, I guess sort of a meta question I have is, what do we need supersymmetry for anymore? Like, what is it, what's the value added? I mean, I think it's worth mapping out the territory to see what it does and does not do. But when I was a boy, what was supposed to happen is there would be one simple group that was supersymmetric and all physics would flow out. Now, if I understand your results correctly, that's bad news for asymptotic safety. But more generally, especially in view of the LHC, what do we need it for?
Yeah, I very much like the question. Okay, the way I look at it is, however, just the other way around. Okay, so
I think he has a point of view.
Okay.
I think there's a second one.
I understand the historical development of supersymmetry. It has been and continues to be an important guiding principle. Okay, we know that it's compatible with all we know about local quantum fields to the extent that some people wonder why isn't it even realized in nature. Okay. And people also used it as an argument in favor of finding new physics, maybe at TV scales, whatever. Okay? Of course, there's a high level of frustration now in certain quarters that this new physics hasn't appeared and materialized, and one might very well question the necessity of supersymmetry. Now, the way I tend to look at it is, as I tried to say, just the other way around. Okay? I think for more than 40 years, the possibility of having an asymptotically safe completion of the standard model has been kind of overlooked. It is there, okay, it has its own structural fingerprints, okay, but it is there. We now have abundant proof that this is a concept which does exist, okay? So it is meaningful now to ask more, say, harder phenomenological questions and try to figure out whether some extensions of the standard model would be compatible with this. Now, since these theories have now interacting fixed points in one form or another, they are going to deliver different answers to the riddles we are normally addressing in the standard model. And this is because simply because the structural ingredients are different. When you have a fixed point, things will be different. Already naturalness looks completely different as soon as you have an interacting fixed point. Okay? So from that angle, it appears to me totally natural to also ask what's now going to happen with this beautiful symmetry principle of supersymmetry in the context with asymptotic safety. I'm not using supersymmetry, I wouldn't want to use it for the same type of things it had been used until now. I want to have a fresh look at it. Okay, and so the one thing which came out of this study is that supersymmetry leads to an enhanced predictivity. And what I mean with this is the following. As you've seen, we now understand that for supersymmetry, at least recoupling, we need two gauge factors. Then we have one asymptotically safe trajectory going out of it. Okay? So it means that although you have two gauge factors, they are no longer independent. They depend. There's only one free parameter. So you might think you have an SU2 cross SU3 SUSY theory, yes, with two independent couplings, but that's absolutely not true. This theory has enhanced predictivity. It's like unification of couplings. It's a theory where only one coupling is truly free.
I mean, that was the one, though.
Okay.
So, can I interject? When I asked you earlier about whether you were imagining some scale of breaking of supersymmetry, let me take one of the extreme cases. Suppose that that the scale of supersymmetry breaking is close to gravitational scale.
Okay.
Then, you know, it changes everything that you are just saying. In other words, in what you are saying, there is an implied assumption that this supersymmetry is a low energy symmetry. Then everything you say would apply. But if it is a high energy symmetry, you know, if it's breaking, let's say, I don't know, grand unification scale or something like that, that's not something you are taking into account. In that case, for low energy physics, you would have effective couplings, which are not supersymmetric, and therefore, you know, in that case, you don't need to use supersymmetry for that purpose, but then it would be a statement about lower energies and not about high energies. If you go to the case when eventually you do include gravitational effects as well, then it may be relevant.
But even if we
Daniel, very short answer because Francesco also. Just give a short answer.
I don't understand where your conjecture is coming from because nothing in this analysis makes any assumptions about the scale of supersymmetry.
That quartic couplings and cubic couplings are related to one another. That's in the supersymmetric limit. If you have supersymmetry at higher scales, it makes predictions about the breaking for low energy physics, and in which case you have effective couplings. That changes the assumptions that you are making.
Low energy theory is the standard model.
Yeah, but non-supersymmetric.
Yes.
Yeah, there is no reason to use supersymmetry, that's all.
There can be extensions of the minimal supersymmetric standard model which can run into a fixed point.
Yeah, I think you need to let Francesco
I'll take your argument out of my word. So, yeah, I mean, these are the kind of questions we ask. So, I mean, one is the question, is there a fixed point in a generic field theory? And supersymmetric field theory is part of the field theory, right?
Yeah.
So, this is a reasonable question that you can ask. The reason why I started working on trying to see whether there's a bloody safety in supersymmetry, and I couldn't find it, because it wasn't written by Danny. I actually wanted to stick with it, because as a bloody safety is not guaranteed in supersymmetry, or as a bloody safety is guaranteed in supersymmetry. So it's just a little bit of fun about that. But it's a very defining question. I was interested in non-perturbative results, because in the paper with Danny, in perturbation theory, we could find an asymptotic and safe fixed point. Now, in supersymmetry, I have a more, field theory tools to use. That's how I do it. It's just simply to prove exact results. I want to demonstrate. I'm not interested in phenomenology. I take my head off of phenomenology, and I'm interested just from pure quantum theoretical point of view. Whether you can have a photonic seed in a supersymmetric setup. Now, I immediately noticed that if you indeed, as also later on, if you actually look to the theory that we had before, you had Arduino, and that means no fixed point in the problem. And that is easy to show is that in the second coefficient, it changes the amount of the sign of C. So you've done that. as opposed to the simple answer to imperturbative theory doesn't happen. You can generalize that, but it was pretty clear to me that it didn't happen. But then you could re-have a fixed point, like you have in QCD a larger number of flavors. So if I ask you a question, take super QCD. There is no fixed point in imperturbation theory. Does that exclude the possibility of a non-perturbative fixed point larger than f? Wouldn't you like to know that answer?
I would love to know that answer.
Because, I mean, I know Cyber did a fantastic job in the conformal window of a super QCD that, you know, brought his chair to Princeton. Why not do it in safety rather than free?
But what if that domain is very heavy?
No,
but the issue is, are you taking scales into account?
No, that was my original question.
Again, I'm not doing phenomenology, okay? So let me just do something stupid, a test of peace. So take an SU and engage you, right? So let's make simple things. I have a W alpha, which is my cavity superfield that has the glue and gluing, and this is the adjoint of this. Then I have a quark in the super, and this is a cavity superfield, so my Q is psi Q plus, pi Q plus square root of 2 theta psi Q plus F Q square, and then I have my other quark in the empty fundamental representation. And this has an S Q and F cross S U and F cross U1R anomaly free field. Now, this is a modifier, so this is a singlet, zero charge, one depends on the notation, and then this one is fundamental singlet charge plus one, and then this, I think, is MF over MC minus one, something like that. And then this and the fundamental minus one. And I ask you, this is a modifying part of the view. Cyber solved it for us. When the first coefficient of beta function is 3nf, 3nc minus nf. I mean, you guys have omega. I'm taking the upper speed space, so don't make mistakes. It's free. So this is my first coefficient of the beta function. And when this is actually positive, and n is less than 3 and c, the periodicity freedom, there is an infrared fixed point, and Cyber just provided this conformal window here, which is like that. This is an f equal to 3 and c, and then there is a lower bound of conformal window at n equal to 3 alpha and c, and then there are, and so on. That has seemed to be breaking the confinements of what's on you. You know, and this is all non-perturbative, right? I also know that above here, I cannot have asymptotic safety, because the same applies here. And the question I ask is that, what happens here? Do you have UV completion of this theory when NF is large? So if I ask you this question, what would your answer be? I want to solve this theory. It's just, I don't care about gravity, I don't care about anything. I want to solve it. It's pretty cool to have something solved, right? So the question now I go, I would like to find out, I want to complete Cyber window. What would you say? It's a yes and no answer. Does this theory have a fixed point in the parameter? It doesn't. It's the critical number of flavor parts for this happens. I love yes and no answers. Yes, that is, no, that is. What is your answer?
What's your answer?
No, I mean, it's still a free. This theory is free for any NF above that, right? I can prove it. So this theory is absolutely free. No perturbative theory. And I can prove it with a number of theorems. That means that if you were to assume super QCD, you would even think of the lattice to find this asymptotic as a fixed point, because I can prove it to you that it doesn't exist. How many things you can prove in real life? Not too many. So this is actually true. The theory is true. Now I can use a plethora of different non-perturbative tools to
to generalize this to a large class of theories, including the one that Daniel was studying in perturbation theory. But I don't need perturbation theory. I can prove it for any NF, any C, for any integer F, any integer C, that it doesn't happen. I think this is a pretty cool stuff. I mean, I hate supersymmetry when it comes to phenomenology. But I certainly love the power of proving something, right? Makes sense. I mean, as I said, it's not that you have to lack with it, but...
So okay, I just understand the claim is that this theory for any SUN super QCD with any number of flavors, it becomes true.
Yes, exactly. However, you can do the QCD one.
If it's super.
If it's super. If it's not super, and F is larger than C, then I actually have a similar diagram in infrared. After a lot of differences, but here I can imagine the theory to become separate, which we use in our paper. Now, we're using our paper this. But now I'm telling you, our theories, the one we used for doing asymptotic and safe tunnel model, can never be supersynchronized at a higher energy scale. Because it actually destroys the dramatic fixed point, even if you had one.
So they're in conflict.
Not conflict whatsoever. They're two different theories.
Well, what I meant is the idea of taking both is in conflict.
Right. The idea that, for example, you have alpha as a function of the energy, and it goes to a fixed point which is authorizing. And then you say from here on, they want to supersymmetrize, right? They say that it comes to Lima and says, I will have split asymptotic safety. You can do that. And the answer is, yeah, but you're going to lose the fixed point. And you're never going to reinstate it. It doesn't go to something other fixed point here. Right? I can prove it to you. You don't have to think about it.
That's what I mean. The idea of the fixed point is in conflict with Susie. That's
exactly.
What I'm trying to say.
It's in conflict with Susie, and you can move it to it. So I don't, it's just theorems, right? I don't need to care about particularly.
He does, I think.
May I ask
my question
one more time?
Sure, sorry.
So, does the proof depend on the scale of supersymmetry?
Yes, exactly. I agree. So, okay. Now you tell me accuracy enough from a phenomenological point of view, there is the gradient theory, right?
Well, even before, just Susie scale breaking.
Yes.
So,
okay, fine. So from here on, I say M Susie breaking, right?
Yeah. For example, does it depend on, does the proof depend?
No. On that? It's independent of any mass scale.
So,
I can prove that.
I'm not understanding that.
Yeah.
Because massive fields basically are irrelevant. In your calculation, massive fields are irrelevant, decoupled. In your calculation, which means that if the masses are above some Susie breaking, you should not be including them in the calculation.
Exactly. Yeah.
So therefore, all your Casimirs, etc., should not be including those super partners.
Good question. So, but I can also answer very well. It's a bit like my cup of tea. So, there are mass ratios. Now, the presence, as long as the anomalous dimensions of these operators does not affect the presence of the fixed point. And I can calculate in supersymmetry because in supersymmetry it's not a special, it's not one, they're protected. They're dependent on the other chapter. Okay. So if I can use, to prove these things in mass independence, then I can decouple, you're decoupling fields going down.
It's not only about the couplings, it's also, you see, in calculating those beta function coefficients, you are computing certain Casimirs.
Yes.
In those Casimirs, you are including fermions as well as bosons. All the superconductors are being included. If you are doing that computation at low energies, it should be a different computation at high energies, because at low energies, those superparticles should not be included.
Exactly. So,
therefore, so that's the question.
Totally. But in fact, for doing Susi stuff, I don't need to write a beta function. For Susi stuff, it's enough that there will be air charge at the theory is fixed. And because of all these air charges, the protective operator is part of the supercool. I can actually just calculate it. And then all I need to do is to calculate the air charge in infrared.
I'm getting lost. Okay?
Yeah,
because I'm not getting an answer.
No, but
in your loops, when you are calculating beta function, and in your loops, you are. There are certain things running.
So the super partners should not be running when you are at low energies, should not be included, and therefore the Casimirs, that those coefficients are different.
If I
what is being included in the loop?
We have to turn it on, but yeah, we don't have too much time to finish on the discussion,
no,
so maybe do a quick answer.
I just want to show how you do it. I'll give you an alternative way of doing that, a prescription to actually calculate, which of course is not in mind, but this can just incorporate
So how does that fit with the infinite order beta function?
Perfectly. It's the beta function directly proportional to indeed.
No, I meant you claim that large NF is trivial.
Yeah, it works perfectly.
But I thought people had looked into large NF.
In supersedent.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they found a fixed point with Novikov.
Yeah, that's wrong. Because the question is that zero in the beta function doesn't mean there is a zero in zeros.
No, of course not. No. What's wrong with Novikov then?
It's just that it's like, for example, this is driven inside. If you go inside, right, you go to infrared fixed point, the beta function of MSBZ has a fixed point where it doesn't exist. That's why you need to calculate the normal dimension and have an independent test of the z. The zero in the fixed in the beta function is not necessarily a fixed part. It's your only perturbation theory. Independent activity. Otherwise it's not true.
So Francesco, we are running low on time, so 2 more minutes.
Yes, sorry.
So what's the statement about the is it every supersymmetric theory or just the one? Is it any supersymmetric theory or just the SUN? Just simple.
No, you can generalize to a vast class of
including whatever mesons or something, scalar mesons.
Yeah. Actually, it's even easier.
Okay.
Because those are automatically already very balanced.
Right.
Very real. So actually, the sneaky part is the one that measure. Sorry.
Okay, so maybe.
Sorry, Astrid.
But while you look for it, maybe I can make a very quick announcement. There is something that everybody should think about over lunch, namely a logistical question. So we have the opportunity to go out for dinner tomorrow to a nearby restaurant. So you all have a bistro credit, so we could just have dinner here, or we thought it might be nice to go out for dinner jointly. In that case, everybody would have to pay for their own dinner. So there's a decision to make whether we want to do that or not. And this is something that you can think of over lunch, and we'll do a poll afterwards of whether we want to do that or not. And so in the meantime, maybe Francesco has found a remote.
But start thinking about it. This must be out there. Yes. Okay. So, good.
So 1 minute.
So what can I use to exclude the presence of a fixed point? Right. In general, I can actually use the any operator, which is a gauge singular. The imaginary operator must be larger than one. And in super symmetry, you have one thing that you don't have outside super symmetry. Right? The imaginary operator is 3 alpha of the arc-charge operator. And that is something that you simply don't have outside super symmetry. And the arc-charge you can think about when you want an axial anomaly, only that is related to the superconformal charge. For example, in super QCD, the dimension of Q is 3 alpha the r dimension of the spectrum. Now look exactly, and then you have other thing you can calculate, which is the coefficient of the superconformal anomaly, which is associated with Riemann
curvature, and it's a three times times the trace of u cubed minus the trace of u1. This is the eigen function, and you can calculate the sigma function, which actually is a different linear combination of the same star. This you can consider as the standard tooth anomaly for the u1 cube, and this is the gravitational anomaly. This. And this, you know, you don't really know what these are the numbers, but that's it is. That's what it is. And then you can calculate the third one, which is the flavor anomalies. You have a theorem that tells you, and it's true in supersymmetry, that all these three quantities must be positive at fixed point. So you can allegedly say there is a fixed point, then these three must be positive. If one of them is negative, forget about the fixed point. In fact, they're not that constrained. And then there's also something else called A over C, which is the Maldacena of collided bounds on this ratio. The truth is that what is really constraining in most of these cases is the delta A. So now you have a theory. For example, you were saying as a neutralized fixed point, but what happens in ether? So I only need to know the endpoints of it and nothing else. What happens in between, I don't give it up. And calculate the delta A. If delta A is negative, there is no fixed point in ultraviolet, nor in infrared. And that's the beauty of it. This I can calculate without doing, I mean, just algebraically. For a generic gauge calculator, I can just calculate.
I'm not so sure that your claim is entirely correct, because we investigated that in detail, and for the semi-simple supersymmetric. Let me say the point.
Yeah.
Let me make my point, okay? So. It's a quantum field theory which has a variety of fixed points, including the Gaussian and the UV fixed point. If I compute this number between the UV and the Gaussian, it's going to be negative.
Yes.
So you just said that this means neither the UV nor the Gaussian well exist, which is not correct.
No. So
it simply means that if these fixed points exist.
Yeah.
Then the theory is only consistent if there is not a singular G trajectory on which we can factually flow from that one to the other fixed point. It does not necessarily entail that these fixed points do not exist.
That is true. So under the hypothesis, if there is a trajectory between these two, they don't exist. If there isn't, you can.
Then at least there is an issue.
Not there. But I'm assuming there is a trajectory.
Okay, so. You flash some formulas, algebraic formulas.
Yes, so,
So now those algebraic formulas, don't they depend? So they are some loop computations, right?
Yes.
So they are coming from some loop computations.
Yes.
Don't they depend on what is running in the loop?
Absolutely.
But wait. Yes. If you agree that it does depend on what runs in the loop.
Oh, absolutely.
If in that loop you have a candidate, a super partner, and if that super partner is super heavy, then you should not be including.
Exactly.
Which means your formula is not the same.
No, exactly.
When it is at high energy versus low energy,
right.
there is a scale that differentiates between high and low energies. So your algebraic formulas are not the same.
Yes.
They look similar, but they are not the same.
Let me go down and say, if I have a flow between the supervalued and different, and provided that you can tell me, or I can tell you, that I know what is expected in ultraviolet, what is expected in infrared, then I can calculate this. Yes.
So I'm very sorry, but I'll have to cut off the discussion here. We're already more than 15 minutes late for lunch. And I propose that, you know, this discussion can be continued privately, or we have lots of room for further discussions in the schedule. So let's go for lunch for now, and we reconvene at 2 p.m.